This podcast is brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Marty Roan, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
One of the big names in the Australian music industry, remember denim and lace and a mean pair of jeans? Australian musician, pop singer, songwriter, actor, and stadium show producer, Marty Roan is my podcast guest. Hello, Marty.
Hi, Gav.
Now, Marty, it's great to talk to you. We've had lots of things in our life together, so let's go through them. But I want to go right back into Marty Roan, right back in the early days when you were born to what was then East Java as Carl Lawrence Van Roon. Did I get the pronunciation right?
No, it's actually Carl. It's Czechoslovakian, but don't worry, mate. I used to get letters right up until I changed to a stage name addressed to Miss Carl Van Roon.
Oh, dear. Tell me about the origins of that name, though.
My parents, like a lot of parents, like to be that little bit different. And I think it was my mother had read somewhere about someone, Karel, which is, as people from Europe would probably know, as a Czechoslovakian name. So why a young Eurasian boy from Australia should be named with a Czechoslovakian Christian name. I'll have to ask my mother when I get up there.
Now, mother was born in Australia, wasn't she?
She was. She was a redheaded wranger with freckles.
You're kidding me.
No, my mother was a redhead. She had lots of freckles. That's why I ended up with freckles and why whenever I grew a beard, it was red.
Well, I've never seen you with a beard. That's obviously why.
It takes too long, Gav.
Yeah, same with me. How was your early life in East Java? How was that for you as a young boy?
I don't remember a thing about it because we came out here when I was 2 years old.
Oh, well, you wouldn't remember anything.
No, but I can tell you it was a very frightening time for my parents because it was right in the middle of the Indonesian Revolution, seeking, freedom from Dutch colonialism. And we actually owe our lives to this sounds very colonial, but you'll understand what I mean. We owe our lives to our Indonesian servants who actually we had guerrilla fighters come into the property. They hid mum and I in a closet and persuaded the guerrilla fighters to leave us alone. We owe our lives to them.
Gee, that is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, tell me about your father. He seems like a really interesting guy.
Dad was in the Dutch Air Force Navy in the Dutch East Indies at the time. He was on the Dutch Catalina flying boat that actually spotted the Japanese fleet coming down to Java.
You're kidding me. Is that right?
He was the navigator on the actual Catalina that spotted the Japanese fleet, and he told me how he was asked by the people at the other end of the radio, how many ships are there? He said, I lost count at about 80.
Oh, that would have been such a shock to him.
Yeah, it was. And, of course, it was only a matter of months, and most of Dad's family ended up in prisoner of war camps. Dad's father, who was a military man, he died. Dad was on the Burma Railroad and was eventually flown back to Tokyo as a prisoner of war. And he was actually in Tokyo when the American bombing started at Tokyo, the carpet bombing. Virtually, he's lucky to have got out of there alive.
Gee. So you landed in Darwin, is that correct?
We did. We came back to Sydney first, and then my dad bought a car. He bought a Skoda at a car dealership, which is a Czechoslovakian car by irony, and then drove it into the showroom wall. Dad wasn't the best driver in the world, but we all piled into the Skoda and moved to Darwin because Dad got a job up there. And so I spent, I think, from the ages of 4 to 11 in Darwin. One of the most marvellous memories for me was living in Darwin.
Now, did you have brothers and sisters then?
My brother and sister came along 10 and 12 years later. I'm far and away the eldest in the family. They were born just before we left Darwin. My sister is 10 years younger than I am, and my brother is 12 years younger than I am. And my father was a professional jazz pianist, jazz musician, had his own band in the Northern Territory. He was the biggest musician in the whole of the Northern Territory because he was a very, very accomplished jazz pianist in the Errol Garner, Oscar Peterson.
The big band kind of era.
The big band era. My mother sang with Dad's band, and she was also an actress. I just have wonderful memories of that time in Darwin. They tell the story how when they went off to gigs, they used to take me in a bassinet and put me in the dressing room, and then they'd go out and perform and all that stuff. But had some wonderful memories in Darwin. I played Aussie Rules. It was the first sport I ever played in Darwin, Aussie Rules.
You would have been accepted very well up there?
In one word, no.
I worried about that question. How did you fit in?
Well, at first it was very difficult because Darwin at the time was very much a frontier town. We're talking 50s here. Yeah. There was a lot of suspicion. You know, I mean, I don't look all that Asian, but I look different enough to the locals up there initially to be sort of classed as Asian. And Dad looked a lot more Asian than I did because Dad's half and I'm quarter. There was a lot of racism at the time and there was a lot of suspicion. This being, of course, only about a decade after the war. All the buildings were still damaged from the Japanese attack on Darwin. There were a lot of memories of all of this. And, of course, if you look mildly Oriental, you copped a lot of flack.
Because your dad was so accomplished in piano and entertaining, and so was your mum, did you use music as a kind of a, hey, I'm pretty cool, love me, as a kid? Because I know a lot of musos, when they picked up the guitar, all of a sudden they went from a dork to a cool kid.
Interestingly enough, I was more interested in sport. I played Aussie Rules, I played a bit of basketball, and my father tried to get me to learn the piano, and I regret to this day not actually taking up on it. But I can tell you, being taught by your parents is not the most easy thing in the world. And I'm always for going to independent teachers to learn how to, you know, learn how to play instruments. But Dad encouraged me, because Mum used to always sing at home with Dad around the piano, Dad encouraged me to appear with him at the Boy Scout Jamboree in Darwin. I think I was about 11 years old. I appeared on stage with Dad. The town hall in Darwin was packed, and I can still remember the two songs I sang. One was Route 66, not the Rolling Stones version, but the original Nat King Cole version. The other song I sang was Volare.
Well, it's the time. It was the time.
It was the 50s. I got my first EP. My folks had bought me my first EP and my first single, and the first single they bought me was Boom Boom Baby, Crash Craddock. And the second EP was the Jailhouse Rock EP.
Oh, what an indoctrination.
That's when I discovered Elvis.
And you've loved him ever since, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. The Beatles came along and distracted me for a time. But no, I've always been a big fan of Elvis. And as I said, the Beatles. That actually, probably my biggest musical influence was the Beatles. I can honestly say it was the excitement of when the Beatles came along that galvanised me and encouraged me to get into the business.
Did you see them at the Horden Pavilion?
No, they were at the stadium. I had front row seats, camped out at Parling's Music Store at 3:30 a.m. in the morning, was second in line and got front row seats to the stadium concert. Didn't hear a thing.
But just to see John, Paul, George and Ringo live on stage, I mean, that was worth the ticket, wasn't it?
I was literally 5 metres away from them. I could see the sweat on their faces and I couldn't hear what they were singing.
Oh, that must have been so frustrating. But still, look, that would have spurred you on because you were very young to be signed to a record company. I mean, how did that happen?
I just finished my final exams at high school and I answered an ad that Channel 9 was running for an audition for what I thought was for Saturday Date, which was the big television show at the time, compared by Jimmy Hannon. Uh-huh. And I went along to the studio with my high school band, literally the day before the final exams and my leaving certificate. Yeah. Went out and performed. I can remember what one of the songs we sang was Roll Over Beethoven, ironically. Yeah. And Nat Kipner walked out of the sound booth at the television studio, 9 studios in Artarmon, and he walked up to me and he pulled me aside and he said, I'd like you to come into the offices of Sir Frank Packer, Consolidated Press tomorrow. I want to talk to you about a record deal. Wow. And I said, can I bring the guys along? And he said, no. He said, because I like you, I hated the band.
So Nat Kipner, of course, was father of Steve Kipner
from
Tintin, and they had that song Toast and Marmalade for Tea.
Absolutely. And, of course, Steve Kipner wrote Physical for Olivia and wrote Genie in a Bottle for Christina Aguilera. And Steve and the Board was Spin Records, which was that famous little independent label that the Bee Gees signed to. He was the A&R man for Spin. And anyway, I went into a Consolidated Press the next morning, and he said, I want to offer you a 7-year recording contract. And that was unheard of in those days. It was a really fascinating time because Spin Records was a great little independent label. It had Ronnie Burns, it had myself, it had Tony Barber from Thorpey and the Aztecs, and of course, the Bee Gees, and Jeff St. John and Copper Wine. It's a great little independent label. And we used to record at the back of a butcher shop out at Hurstville, Ozzie Byrne and his recording studio. Of course, Nat and Steve went back to America after a couple of years, and then they made it, you know, huge in America as songwriters. And then I couldn't buy a hit record in those days. But I was locked into this 7-year recording contract. So I just literally churned out song after song. And it was literally out of sort of desperation in the end, where the record company said, "Do you write your own songs?" He said, "Because these covers aren't working, you know."
Tobin Brothers believe every life is unique. Every funeral should be too. Visit turbanbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Marty Roan, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Well, let's go back to just when you signed that contract. Didn't you open for the Rolling Stones?
Well, I did. I was, I'd just been signed to Spin, which was owned by Sir Frank Packer, and Harry and Miller was bringing out the Rolling Stones. And Sir Frank, who was friends with Harry, said, "Harry, we've got this new guy. We've got this new guy we just signed to a record label. You put him on your show." So I, as a 17-year-old, straight out of school young boy, was signed as a support act to the Rolling Stones. The other acts on the bill were The Searchers and Max Merritt and the Meteors, their first Australia tour.
Oh, gee, that's history, man.
It is, Gav. I mean, it's amazing. And my funniest introduction to the Rolling Stones was their manager came up to me in my dressing room, which was this great cavernous thing at the Horton, the Agricultural Pavilion out at the showgrounds in Sydney. He came up to me, and he must have felt sorry for me because I was the only person in his great cavernous dressing room. Mm. He said, "Would you like to meet the boys?" And I said, "Oh, I'd love to, of course." And my first and only biggest memory or greatest memory of meeting the Rolling Stones was walking into their dressing room and smelling this strong, pungent odour. And all I can remember is walking out of there feeling incredibly happy.
Oh, you would have done a good show.
Mate, I floated up the stairs to get on stage.
What a great career. I mean, your career was absolutely flying after that, but then you were one of the chosen few to serve in the Vietnam War from 70 to 72. That kind of put the brakes on it.
It certainly did. I mean, I remember when I got the letter. Because I wasn't born in Australia, I had a one-year grace. This is the stupidity of governments. I wasn't able to be called up at 20, but I was able to be called up at 21. I had a year knowing that I was going to get called up. But I can tell you that the day Normie was discharged was the day I went in.
No, really? I remember that day. That was on all the television networks, that when Normie came out with his short hair.
Yeah, well, all the cameras were down that end of the street when Normie came out.
You missed the photo op.
I missed the photo op. I just sort of slunk my way into it. Sign up and get my hair cut. I remember my first day at Puckapunyal, where all my company, Rex Hunt was in my company, the footballer, and Alan Noonan, the Essendon star. We're all in the same company at Puckapunyal, and we're all standing on the balcony waiting to go in and have our hair cut. And this sergeant, this tough, gruff sergeant with a cigarette hanging out the side of his mouth, walked up and down the veranda in front of us, and he stopped at the line. He said, "Which one of yous is the singer?" He zeroed in on me and he said, "You're first."
That's cruel. That's real cruel.
I was the first one to get the bowl cut, you know?
That was kind of near the end of the war, wasn't it? And not only were they being selective, but, the ones that were a lot called up never went to Vietnam.
The real reason why I never went to Vietnam was that I got into the band corps, being a musician and being a singer, and I was sent down to Balcombe, which was the army training camp for army musicians at the time. And the first thing you notice when you walked into the band hall where you did your rehearsals and playing was this memorial to something like 10 apprentice musicians who died at the Battle of Long Tan, from memory, because back before they changed the rules, musicians were stretcher bearers. And it was the musicians in Vietnam that used to jump off the helicopters and go and pick up the wounded. And at one particular battle, and I think it was Long Tan, they lost about 10 of them. And this is because they had nothing to protect themselves. All they were doing was jumping off helicopters with stretchers and collecting the wounded. So following that situation, they stopped using musicians as stretcher bearers. And from that point on, I think the musicians were taken out of the medical corps, which they were assigned to, and so no more were sent to Vietnam.
Aren't you a lucky boy?
I'm a very lucky boy. Very sad and sobering effect that had on me when I walked into that band room and saw that memorial.
So what part did you play in the, was it Army? Army band?
Army band, military college band. You could put down your preferences where you wanted to go. So I was in Melbourne at the time, so I put my first preference as the Melbourne military band, and then my second preference was the Sydney military band, and my third preference was Canberra, because I'd learnt to play the flute when I knew I was being called up. So I was sent off to Duntroon, which sounded all wonderful and everything, until I got there. And I think I was going to have this cushy time sitting down on third flute in the military band at Duntroon. And I walked into the band room and there were three vacant seats at the end of one of the lines. And I said, which is my seat? And they said, the one on the end. And I said, why is that my seat? Aren't I third flute? And they said, no, you are the flautist.
Oh, you're the man.
And I'd only been playing flute for about 3 months.
No, really?
Yeah, I can always remember the captain who was the leader walked into the band room for the first rehearsal and we got this whole pile of music in front of us and he said, all right, gents, put up the 1812 overture.
Oh. Start from the top.
And I was on first flute and I remember flipping through the pages and all I could see was bird shit.
That's funny. You would have shat yourself.
I absolutely did. And I looked at it. It's got in one part, it's got flute solo. And I turned to the guy next to me and I said, I can't play that.
So how did you get out of that?
I learned it off by heart. I wasn't a good enough reader at that point. I did become a better reader later on. I would go to the band room every night after mess for about 2 hours, and I would learn those flute solos off by heart.
Incredible.
We're performing in front of this huge crowd up on the parade ground and the Governor General. Yeah. So the last thing I wanted for there to be a nice, quiet, sedate moment in the song in my first flute solo.
So after the Army, you became a civilian again. What was your mindset? A full-on music career?
While I was in the Army, I had a good chance to look at the Australian entertainment industry from outside. So I was able to observe from outside. And I came to the conclusion that possibly the best way to re-establish myself after nearly 2 years out of the industry was to try and break into acting. And as fate would have it, the very first audition my agent sent me to was for the original Sydney season of Godspell. And I got a part in Godspell with John Waters, Peter Tapano. It was just the most amazing experience. You couldn't ask for a better introduction to acting.
Well, a stage musical, I mean, that's just a perfect transition from what you were doing to then, you know, learning your stagecraft.
And a hugely successful stage musical as well.
Now, around then, or just before then, you were signed with M7 Records. How did that come about?
I was doing, fast forward a couple of years, and I was doing Class of 75 on the 7 Network. Mm-hmm. And I was playing a character called Tom Carter, a school student. One of the ironies was that I was 27 at the time playing a school student. The guy playing my teacher was 25. The producers were approached by Universal Music, the publishers, and they said, look, you got this guy called Marty Ronan. We've got this song for him called Denim and Lace. We'd love to record it. And this, what they then suggested was very, very clever. They said, would the scriptwriters write a plot around Marty writing this song called Denim and Lace into the plot of the series?
Yeah, all works for me.
So they released the song to radio the day the episode aired.
Fantastic. And that's about when I met you up in Brisbane at 4BK.
It is.
When you're up there promoting it.
Yep, so I had about a 10-year wait to really... as they say in the classics, hit the big time record-wise.
Yeah. And then a couple of years later, A Mean Pair of Jeans came along.
Exactly, yeah.
And now, did you write that one?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, I can tell you about Denim and Lace. Having already knocked back Waterloo by ABBA and The Little Ray of Sunshine.
You idiot.
I know. A double idiot, because I knocked back Brad's Little Ray of Sunshine.
How were you to know that those two songs were going to be absolute mega hits? How could you even look into the future and see that?
Because I'm stupid.
Yeah, well, anyway, Denim and Lace is a good song.
Yeah, and it 1975, second biggest selling in Australia, that single.
There you go. See, you got your hit.
I wasn't going to knock it back a third time.
So you had 2 years. You're on Countdown, hosting Countdown, doing Denim and Lace, and then the follow-up song, A Mean Pair of Jeans. Did the record company say, can you write any songs?
Yeah, but much to the record company's horror, I moved overseas to London.
Oh, for The King and I.
Yeah.
That was the Yul Brynner, King and I. What a great thing to get. How did you actually get that as a young entertainer in Sydney, and all of a sudden you're on a plane, you're going to London?
I'd gone to London, and I was back in Australia about 3 months later doing the Mean Pair of Jeans tour. And I was in a little town called Sawtell on the New South Wales north coast. Mm. 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning, the manager of the motel knocks on my door and says, I've got a phone call for you from London. I thought, London? So I took the call, and there was my London agent. He said, look, when are you back in London? I said, the end of next week. And he said, well, I'll organise an audition for you for The King and I. And my first reaction was, because I'd gone to England to further my recording career, my first reaction was, I said, who's in it?
Oh, there's some American actor called Yul Brynner.
Yes. Well, of course, I said, yeah, I'll be there. Yeah. But I had to audition 7 times before I got that role. And the last time was in front of the great man himself. It was an empty theatre, and he was up the back of the stalls. I couldn't see him. And I walked out on stage, and I sang I Have Dreamed, which is from the show. I sang it, and then when I finished, I was just about to walk off stage, and this booming voice comes out of the shadows of the back room saying, can you sing it in a higher key? And I'll sing it in any key.
Yes. Nee, stop knocking.
And so I did, and Brynner gave me the nod.
Gee, that was 1979, 1980.
Yep, ran for 18 months, record-breaking season, and one of the great experiences of my career. The fact that it was Brynner, the people that were attracted to that show, you know, celebrity, I don't want to sound like a name drop here, but celebrity.
No, come on, name drop. This is good. Who came to see you?
Okay, Robert De Niro, Dustin Hoffman. Front row one night was Sally Field and Burt Reynolds, who were
at Stop that.
Time. Yeah.
Wow.
Cliff Richard. Danny LaRue, I met Princess Margaret. She came backstage. I met King Hussein of Jordan, the late King Hussein of Jordan, his wife, Queen Noor. Yeah. There was always, every week, because it was Brynner, because it was The King and I, because it was such an iconic stage production, there was always someone of note every week in the audience, you know, and this... this stage director, who's only just recently got in touch with me, reconnected, a guy called Richard. You just before I'd go to walk on stage, you'd come up and you'd say, De Niro's in the audience. So I'd go, tell Richard.
Oh, mate, that's fantastic. Just amazing stuff. Now, you actually stuck it up the English arts community because they wanted to get rid of you.
The British Equity initially refused to give me a work permit because they said it should go to an Englishman.
Right.
Just fortuitously for me, the day I was knocked back for a work permit, Bobby Lim, who was the president of Equity at the time, arrived in London, and I knew Bobby, and just as fate would have it, Gav, he called me that day when he arrived in London. And I invited him around for dinner, and I told him the whole story, and he said, meet me down at Australia House tomorrow morning, and we'll go and see the New South Wales Consul General, who was Peter Falkenberg at the time. So I met, cut a long story short, I met Bobby down there. We went and saw Peter Falkenberg, told him the story. And while we're in his office, he picks up the phone and he dials a number and someone answers at the other end. He says, hey, Nev, it's Peter here in London.
Neville Wran. Okay.
He was speaking to Neville Wran, and he told us afterwards, after he finished the conversation with Neville Wran, that Neville Wran had said to him, tell British Equity that if Marty Roan does not get that work permit, there will be no English artists working in New South Wales this weekend.
Oh, he was a good Premier of New South Wales, wasn't he, Neville Wran? I like that.
He was a tough cookie, and I owe it to Bobby Lim, and I owe it to Neville Wran for getting me that role in The King and I, because you can imagine, here I am, an unknown actor in London. If I didn't have that support, I would have just been given the flick, you know. And
yeah, you wouldn't have got on stage.
I wouldn't have got on stage. So I owe so much to those two gentlemen. Forever be grateful for giving me that opportunity.
Any song can be played at a funeral. What would you like? Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Marty Roan, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Now, after coming back to Australia, Marty Roan's career has got to continue on. You're a regular on the Don Lane show, singing all the hits of the day between 75 and 83. That was great to see what costume they put you in and what set they put you in and what dances they had had around you. It was a full-blown production, wasn't it?
I mean, the production values of the Don Lane show and even the midday show, the production standards, as it was so great, you were presented in the very best light, and it was very opportune for me. It was very opportune to get that chance, because I think without it, it would have taken me a long time to reestablish myself, because I'd been out of the country for 4 years.
Now, after that, of course, good things kind of come to an end and or slow down. You know, the sports clubs in Sydney, you know, well, the pokey started to come in, and all of a sudden entertainment kind of waned away. You got into sports management, looking after the Waters brothers, and they were boxers, Dean, Guy and Troy. How was that experience, Marty?
Very forgettable.
I knew you'd say that.
Look, nothing against Troy. I really like Troy, and he sadly passed away prematurely a few years back. But I tell you what, it taught me so much. I have great admiration for boxers, don't get me wrong. I have great admiration for what they put through it. But I've got to say, it's a mug's game, in my view. It's a game, because the people that make the money are the promoters and that. And at the end of the day, you know, very seldom do you hear a good ending to a boxer's story, you know. It's very stressful. I had to deal with Cess Waters, their father, and as everybody knows, he was a bit of a tyrant, the old Cess.
Nothing worse than a stage father.
Oh, yeah, but he was ruthless. The irony is that Cess's drive got them to where they got to, but it was also his self-centeredness, I think, that brought them down, brought them undone.
That's just so selfish, isn't it, when you think about it?
Well, I got them the story on 60 Minutes. It literally, you know, made them into page one sporting stars. And then, of course, the second 60 Minutes story didn't have such a great ending, because of all the trials.
I got to tell you, you're always working, Marty. Others would have given up, particularly after what you went through with the boxing and all of that. You know, you got into PR. Also, a little later on down the track, around 2007, Marty Rowan, a tribute to Cliff Richard. Great shows around the country, and they were. I went and saw them. You just sang your socks off, and they were fantastic shows. But also because you'd met Cliff Richard, you know, it was a lifelong thing for you, wasn't it, to kind of do something like this?
It was. I had been asked a number of times by different promoters would I do a tribute to Cliff Richard, and I declined many times. And it wasn't until someone said to me, you realise that next year is Cliff's 50th anniversary? And I said, oh, okay, that seems like a reasonable reason to do it. But I said, look, rather than just do Cliff, why don't we do Cliff and the Shadows together again? And so we toured the show as Cliff and the Shadows together again because they hadn't worked together for decades.
Right.
And I invited Hank Marvin to the show in Perth, WA, because he lives in Perth now. And to this day, I don't know whether he took up the offer because I left two tickets at the box office for him and his wife. I don't know to this day whether he came or not, but as fate would have it, a year later, who's touring England and Europe? Cliff and the Shadows together again. It was a great experience as well.
In 2009, you released Legends of the Southern Land with John Swan, Swanee, Johnson Peters, Ray Burgess, Tommy Emmanuel, and yourself. There's a stellar cast there. And what a song, Legends of the Southern Land.
Look, it's still written by Johnson Peters and Johnny Young, I think. Johnson Peters and Johnny Young, or it might be Michael Yule. Great song. Great song. And still selling big on the streaming services these days, always being purchased and bought up on the streaming services. A great song, an Aussie anthem. It's become a bit of an Aussie anthem.
And then 2016, the 50th anniversary album you released, your own 50th anniversary album.
Yes, I did, from the very first recording, which was Nature Boy, right through until something you know a lot about, which is Jealous of the Sky.
Yeah, I love that song. I still love Village Tapestry. I think that's one of your earlier songs. It's just, it hits a chord with me still.
It's the first song I wrote for Spin Records when they said to me, do you write any of your own songs? That was the first one I wrote and recorded.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the first. And I still have a soft spot for Village Tapestry because it was the first song that I wrote and ended up on vinyl.
Well, 2017, you released Graceland on the Line, and that's when you and I kind of got back together and we started to talk about things. And you came over to LA and we hooked up, and you got an offer that was too good to be true.
You were with me, Gab. We were sitting in David J. Holman's studio up there, and we played the music video, which is a terrific music video.
Yeah.
We played the music video, and at the end of it, it was, I think it was David's partner at the time, who said, we'd like to produce your first US country album. And of course, that's where that whole US thing started. And, you know, three independent number one single hits later, and it was just another one of those incredible things about my career. It's just, it's sort of over a long period of time, because I've now been in the industry heading on towards 60 years, there's always been something that's come along, you know, and with your support over there and at the time, and it was very happy memories of that time over there, Gav.
Yeah, we had a great time. And I think, you know, the highlight for me was meeting David J. Holman, who, you know, produced all Olivia's Grease songs and Xanadu and all of that. And he tells the story how he got Gene Kelly tap dancing on his kitchen floor because they were wooden floorboards for Xanadu. You know, just a legend. And you walk in, you see the platinum albums, you know, up there for...
Gwen Stefani.
No doubt. Yes, no doubt. Platinum records, you know, triple platinum records. But to meet the man, David J. Holman, was an absolute delight for me. And I know you and him worked so well together.
Yeah, and very unassuming, very quiet man, great record producer. I mean, I was so lucky to have him produce Jealous of the Sky. I was so lucky to work with some great songwriters in that album, Garth Porter, Rob McCormack, Gina Jeffries, who all contributed to that album. It was a great pleasure writing with Garth, you know, and the musicians as well. I got to work with Albert Lee. I got to work with Chad Watson. I got to work with Jay Leach from American Idol. I mean, it was just an incredible time, as you know.
And still one of the greatest albums ever released in my mind. Country music here in Australia should get on it and support it more, Jealous of the Sky. It's just one of those magical albums that are still current today and still as dynamic and still as fresh as the daisy.
Yeah, the difficulty is, of course, I mean, the album had good success in the US and in Europe and the UK. It's a bit of a two-edged sword because, you know, when I was asked to do that country album, I thought I've got to do this to the very best of my ability. I can't just be a fly-by-nighter. I can't just drop in and just say, I'm going to record country album, as many artists as, you know, the work that went into that album, Gab, because you were there, you know how much hard work there was, thought went into that, because I didn't want the country music fraternity to feel that I was just coming in and going to just put together a country album. If I was going to do a country album, I wanted it to be damn good. And I think I achieved that. I think I produced a good country album. There was resistance in this country to it. There was. I had people comment to me directly who were saying, you know, what are you doing a country album? You know, almost as if you're not allowed to. Saying you're not allowed to, but there was resistance, which is disappointing.
Well, it's a country album, but it's also a crossover album because the songs are commercially suitable for, you know, a crossover album. 6 studio albums, 2 compilation albums, over 25 singles. They're all available on www.martyronmusic.com.
All available there. And if you want to see anything about my acting career, you just take the word music out and it's www.martyrone.com, because some exciting things happening on the acting front as well.
I remember you being a judge on, what was that legal show in New York?
Oh, Bull.
I was watching it one night and there's Marty with a wig on.
Yeah, I've got to tell you a funny story about that. I got the part playing a Texas criminal court judge, and I did the audition, although that audition was pretty average, but I still got the part. And then I did an audition for Law and Order, which I thought I nailed, and didn't get the part. But so I got this part of the judge, as you said, in Bull. And during the filming, the director comes up to me, who is a POM, an Englishman, and I said, are you happy with that? He said, yeah, no, that's fine. I said, what about the accent? Did I get the Texas accent right? He said, yeah, but if you want to go and have a word to the dialect coach, he's sitting over in the corner there on the stool. So I went over to the dialect coach for the Texan accent. He was a Cockney.
Oh, no.
Here's a Cockney giving me advice on how to do a Texas accent. And then, I've been working on this other thing for the last 2 years.
Yes, this top secret thing that you can't speak about, but you've been flying over to Fox Studios in LA, I don't know, how many times, 7 or 8 times?
7, and I did the last session here in Melbourne. The crew was in LA, and there was another group in Tokyo, and we were doing some ADR and doing some voiceover stuff for the video game. What I can tell you, I did sign an NDA, which is a non-disclosure agreement, but I can give you a few hints. It's a video game, obviously. I'm working with Elle Fanning and Leia Sadu, two big Hollywood actresses. I'm working with an Oscar-winning director. I'm working with Norman Reedus, who is out of The Walking Dead.
A stellar cast.
I'm pleased to say I've got one of those leading roles, so I'm very, very excited about what I'm doing. I've told you just about as... I've told you more than I've told anyone else.
Yes, any more you'd have to shoot me. Now, this is going to be huge all around the world because they've just spent millions and millions and millions of dollars on development of this particular game. So gaming is huge, isn't it?
Oh, it's massive. It's actually, it's bigger. It pulls in bigger profits than the film industry.
That's astounding.
Exactly. A few years ago when the follow-up to Grand Theft Auto was released, it pulled in over $1 billion within the first month.
Incredible. Now, Marty Rowan has been nominated in the Go Set Pop Poll back in 1967-68. He won a 2010 Mo Award. 2014, nominated for a Hopman Award for Best Male Actor in a Supporting Role in a Musical for The King and I. Congratulations for that. Now, let's get a little personal. How many years have you been married to the lovely and long-suffering Rosa?
I've been married to Rosa. Oh, geez, I better get this right.
No pressure.
Been married for 47 years, known Rosa for 48.
She's a lovely woman. I love her dearly. Where did you meet? Loaded question, of course.
Remembering that this is 1967, we met in a gay coffee lounge.
Well, that was out there. In Oxford Street?
No, this is in Melbourne. The old Australia coffee lounge in Collins Street, Melbourne. Yeah, I walked in there and there was Rosa sitting with her sister, two gorgeous young girls, and they were sitting with the DJ from 10th Avenue. And he had the hots for Rosa and her sister, and he introduced me to them. Biggest mistake he ever made.
Yeah, of course it was. Now you've got two very successful sons. Come on, brag. Tell me about the boys.
All right. They both live and work in America. The eldest, Luke, is married to an American girl. He's we just became grandparents just over a year ago. We still haven't seen our grandson, Leo. We're hoping to get over there towards the end of this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Luke has a great job in Atlanta, Georgia. The youngest, Matthew, lives and works in Salt Lake City. And he's just started his own... good sense, this boy. He's just started his own video game company.
Oh, he heard Dad was going pretty well, so he thought he might get in on. But he was exceptional before that, wasn't he? He was graphic design and all of that. I've seen some of his work. It's spectacular.
Yeah, very clever. Very clever. He's just written his first book, which is a sci-fi book, first of a trilogy. He did a lot of my early work in as you said, in sort of graphic art and all that sort of stuff. And he's just started this new video game company called Terabit. He's actually worked with all the big video game companies, Pokemon, all the major video game companies. So he's got a good background. Luke's got a PhD in health sciences, which is all about the psychological effect of diet and all of that sort of stuff, and getting people on the right diets and you know, learning to live and eat healthy. And he's working for a company in Georgia who do research and all this stuff. So Luke's doing research with that company.
Well, he's a fine example, because there's not an ounce of fat on him. He's got muscles on his muscles.
Muscles.
And he's, yeah. And he's a very good-looking dude.
He used to be a personal trainer, but they've both done. I'm very proud of both of them. They've both done exceedingly well.
Hey, listen, do you have any hobbies?
Oh no, not really. I used to play golf. I haven't played golf for 10 years. I love watching a good movie. I love watching a good television series. So I'm really into sort of watching good movies and things like that. That's what I really enjoy.
Marty Rowan, singer, musician, actor. How could you watch a movie and enjoy it? You'd be watching the acting more than anything, wouldn't you?
No, I can tend to switch off. The only time you really notice the acting is when it's bad. I think the thing I have noticed is that streaming services like, you know, Netflix and Prime and all those things, it's good for the industry because it's giving a lot of work to a lot of people. But, you know, I was just saying the other day to a colleague of mine, I said, you know, I really think we're not making as good movies today as we did maybe a couple of decades ago. Movies are made quickly. They're made on smaller budgets. Look, I can understand that. I've been a producer myself. I can understand all of that. But I just think that it's the great films that we used to watch 20, 30 years ago are now few and far between. And I think that's the downside of it. I think the upside is it's given a lot of work to a lot of people, myself included. But I think it's just, you know, we're not making those classic films anymore.
Marty Ron, what's your favourite food? I've eaten with you a lot, and even I can't zoom in. I think it could be a bit of Chinese there. What's your favourite food?
I like Thai.
Thai,
I like Thai. I like Thai food. I like Korean food.
Right.
And I've got to say this, I like Italian food.
You had to say that because of Rosa, yeah. Otherwise she'd cut your toes off. Now, name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
Oh, Peter Ustinov.
Oh, yes. Or couldn't he tell some stories?
Meryl Streep. Think she's good fun. Gee, I tell you what, I'm struggling because there's so many you can maybe choose from. And I don't know, maybe a great sportsman. Maybe Ange Postecoglou.
How successful is he?
I'd like to talk to him about his sports philosophy, his football philosophy, because it appears that he's a very good people manager, very good sort of person to inspire sports people. I'd like to talk to people that can inspire you, you know?
Final question, Marty, and I thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it so much. What would you say to a budding young singer?
Make yourself as good as you can be. Don't expect that it's going to be handed to you on a platter. To make it in this very, very tough industry, you have got to work at being the very best, and you have to be a little bit clever as well.
Excellent, excellent advice. Now, is there another Rock Proms coming up soon?
Yes, there is. There's a Rock Proms tour happening towards the end of the year.
Tell me how you stumbled across that.
I was invited to the last night of the Proms, a show called The Last Night of the Proms, when I was living in the UK. A friend rang me up and he said, Marty, I've got a couple of tickets to the last night of the Proms. So I said, mate, I'm not into the classics. I don't think I could sit still for 2 hours and listen to classical music, even though I like some classics. He said, what if I told you that Status Quo was playing with the orchestra? I said, where's my ticket?
Yes.
One of the greatest concerts I've ever seen, to actually see a rock band playing with an orchestra with that full, you know, driving sound. Mm. And when you can think you can put an orchestra with Deep Purple, you know, Smoke on the Water, you know, you can put an orchestra behind whatever you want. You can put an orchestra behind, you know, Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love. So you got this power just pumping out, and you got right in the middle of it, you got a raging killer rock band. Mm. And that's what Rock Proms is all about.
Very successful tour, your last tour.
Yeah. That's why we're doing it again this year.
Congratulations, mate. You're always innovative. You're always thinking of new and butte things. And you're always ahead of the game. Continued success, my friend, on stage, behind the stage, and everywhere else that you touch. It all turns to gold for you. And it's just great to call you my friend.
Thank you, Gavin. Likewise. Your sentiments exactly.
You're an absolute rock star, a champion. Give my love to Rosa, and I'll catch up with you soon.
I hope so, Gavin.
Thanks, mate. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
This podcast brought to you thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year.